everyone. It's Thursday, November 7th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Ken Barnes is away at some sort of progressive group, and sitting in for him, as he does on so many occasions, is Fred Portnoy, one of the best radio engineers, I think, on the planet. So thank you so much, Fred, for showing up and replacing Ken. So I was mentioning to Fred this morning that my daughter is in from China. And she has lived everywhere. She's lived in Japan. She's lived in Sweden. She's lived in South Africa. She's lived in Norway. I mean, she lives in Australia. I mean, this is a woman where the world truly is her oyster. I am so jealous, Fred. I can't even take the bus to Boston. Just like, oh, you know. Anyway, so yesterday we went to the little Asian market in town. And I saw this. She saw this. It's a rice seasoning. And I didn't even notice it, but she noticed it. She goes, oh, Mom, you've got to buy some of this. I said, what is it? She said, in Japan, we all used it. I said, well, how do you use it? She said, well, there's probably 6 or 7 varieties of flavorings. The one that I ended up buying was one that was a sort of a salmon-flavored rice seasoning. She said, make your rice, take this, open it up, and just sprinkle it across the top. And you will never eat rice again without it. And I'm telling you. So last night, there I am. And I make a big pot of rice. And I put it on my rice. And I'm like, oh, unfreaking believable. So this morning, I made a rice omelet. And I put it on my omelet. So I am just telling you, this is why I love the fact that my daughter has been around the world, because she exposes me to foods and tastes and things. I mean, it's on the counter. I don't see it. You know, why would I see it? Why would I even think to buy it? And yet because she's lived there, because she's used it. And she said to me, do you know how lucky I am, Mom? I mean, I've had yak milk. You know, I know about rice seasoning. You know, she is very lucky. She is very lucky. The world is extraordinary, and she actually knows that, which I think is fantastic. So we're going to be talking about healthcare today, but before we grab Marshall Allen from ProPublica, I saw a piece at Slate.com, and we spoke a lot this week about the fires in California. And basically, if you are really focusing on what climate change means, it doesn't just mean sea level rise. It means extreme weather. And it also means extreme to the point where we're going to see the California fires, not just in California, but we are almost entering into an era of fires everywhere across the planet. And it is both shocking, and we can somehow think it's happening over there, but that is not going to be the case. We're going to see that kind of situation exist in many places, not only in the United States, but around the world. And someone at Slate.com wrote the following, and I just wanted you to think about it. What it means to evacuate. How do you pack a go bag when you might be leaving everything behind for good? Wow. Unbelievable. And I mean, I'm thinking, wow, that's a story I hope I never have to sort of face. But there was a whole series that they've now posted at Slate.com, and that was one of the most recent ones about the California fire. And let me just read you the other 4 articles that also focus on this, just to give you an idea of the fear, the finality, how do you face the future, how does government respond? So here are the titles. After that article, the hopelessness of wildfire season was one. How about this? More than 200,000 people forced to evacuate by worsening California fires. How about this? There was a lot to burn, what a reporter saw as the tick fire raged in Southern California. And then the last article where they focus on the California wildfires, PG&E agrees to pay $11 billion to settle with insurers over California wildfires. And let me just say something, because we're going to be talking about healthcare with our next guest, because whenever we think about the health insurance racket, what do we think about? But we think about Marshall Allen from ProPublica, because that's his beat and he does it so effectively. But before I grab Marshall Allen, I was looking at these fires in California. And in some cases, the fires have taken away complete towns. Obviously, they've destroyed businesses. They've destroyed homes. It's very difficult to go back. How do you plan for a future? And I just want to remind everyone, you know why you want some kind of universal healthcare system? Because you don't care about the healthcare you have now. You're worried about whether you have a home, a job, the stability of the job, what happens if you lose your job, all these things now on top of floods and fires and what happens. So can you imagine adding and exacerbating the instability of facing climate change and the extreme weather and what it might do to your location and to your future, to have to worry about whether you can go to a doctor when you're sick? Because all those things not only dislocate your life and dislocate maybe even your job, they may even disconnect you from being able to go to a doctor. That's another reason I like Medicare for All. And that's why I think the insurance industry is a scam. But we somehow have conflated the idea of health insurance and health care, and they are not the same. Let me repeat that. They are not the same. So as I mentioned, I go to ProPublica.com, and we love Marshall Allen because he writes for ProPublica, and he has the best beat. The health insurance hustle is basically Marshall's beat. And the piece you wrote is so sad, Marshall, on so many levels, in part because it seems like the organization, both the, I think the hospital she was working with, but more importantly, the insurance company that she was working with, has sort of a Christian underpinning to it. So when I was reading the title, I'm thinking, well, how Christian of them not? And the title of your piece was, How One Employer Stuck a New Mom with a $898,984 bill for her premature baby. And what I think is most important about this, Marshall, is that the person in question had health insurance. Can I repeat this, everyone? She had health insurance, but for whatever reason, that health insurance either wasn't expanded enough to assume this kind of situation, or she didn't notify them in time like you're supposed to notify them in time. But why don't you explain to my audience from your area of expertise, because you really look at really all the sort of holes within the health insurance system and how many of us fall through it, what happened to her and why it was so important for ProPublica not only to expose it, because to some extent it probably exposed the rot that they were able to sort of push onto her. But more importantly, it makes people understand just because you have insurance doesn't mean you have coverage. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Arnie. I'm really happy to be here again with you and appreciate your interest in these topics. So this is a story about a woman named Lauren Bard. And Lauren is a nurse. She works in the emergency room at a facility that's owned by a massive healthcare company called Dignity Health. Dignity Health is based in California. It's one of the biggest five healthcare systems in the whole country. So massive employer, and a lot of people don't realize it, but many employers do what's called self-funding for their health benefits.
Isn't that ERISA?
And that just means...
Isn't that what ERISA
well,
is?
Well, no. Yes, it's
different?
An ERISA plan. That's right.
Right. Okay.
It's an ERISA plan.
Okay.
They're regulated by the Department of Labor, the federal government, and it's basically where the employer foots the bills for the health coverage, not an insurance company. So they'll hire a company like an Aetna or a Cigna or United Healthcare. They'll hire those companies to process the claims mm-hmm. and administer the claims, but it's not actually insurance. It's actually paid for by the employer. And of the 150 million people in the country that get their health benefits through their employer, probably more than half of them are on self-funded plans where the employer actually pays the bills. And
Let me stop you for a second. So you're saying to me that they're really not insurance because it's an employer-funded plan that they then are regulated by labor and not by like Health and Human Services or the insurance department, so they fall under a different sort of oversight?
That's correct. And that's part of what makes the system even more confusing and convoluted it ever should be.
Yeah.
The insurance plans, which are traditional insurance, where you go to an insurance company and they cover you in exchange for you paying a premium, those are regulated by the states.
Right.
And then these self-funded plans are under the Department of Labor.
Okay.
So they're regulated by the federal government.
Okay.
And so in this case, you know, in almost every health plan, they have rules. If you have a baby, you're supposed to sign your baby up onto the plan. And everybody kind of knows that this is how it works. It is sort of... we can even question why we need to have such a rule, you know, when you know a baby is coming and the mother is covered by the benefit plan, you know, whatever. They make you sign up within 30 days, typically. It's within at least 30 days is what the law says.
Okay.
So most plans will have a 31-day deadline for the mom to sign the baby up on the plan.
Now, let me just stop you one quick question. I want to make sure I understand the difference between insurance and what this is, which is not insurance. So if I am covered by insurance right now and I'm going for my, you know, for my care while the baby is in utero, I still need to notify the insurance after I have the baby, even though they clearly know I'm giving birth and I'm having a baby. I still need to somehow put this new baby on my plan because it is a new life. And even though they know that they're being cared for, I still need to make the exerted effort of making sure that this new life is now included under the umbrella of the plan.
That is correct.
Okay.
It's an administrative hassle that you have to make sure you comply with, or else you risk your child not being covered by the plan.
Okay.
So, anyway, Lauren Bard works as a nurse. She knows kind of how the things work a little bit, but her baby is born premature. So her little baby, Sadie, was born at 26 weeks, so almost 3 months premature. The baby only weighed 1.5 pounds.
Wow.
And it's not that Lauren didn't think about adding the baby to the plan. She called Anthem, which was the company that was administering the self-funded plan for her employer.
Right.
So she called Anthem 3 days after the baby was born and said, I want to make sure and add the baby to the plan. They said, no problem, the baby's on the plan. She had the baby at UC Irvine in Southern California. That's not the same company where she works. It's a different company.
Okay.
But they had a good neonatal intensive care unit.
Right.
So she had the baby there. The hospital people also said, your baby is covered under your plan. So she thought everything was okay until 39 days after the baby was born. Now, meanwhile, let me paint the picture a little more for you.
Okay.
She had preeclampsia. She was very sick. She had to spend 9 of those days after the baby was born in the hospital. She had to spend, 10 days before the baby was born and 9 days after the baby was born. She was in the hospital herself because she was very ill.
Right.
And then the baby, of course, was premature and basically clinging to life in the NICU for 105 days total. So she got discharged from the hospital. Then she went and sat at her baby's bedside next to the incubator in the NICU while the baby underwent all kinds of procedures.
Mm-hmm.
Well, day 39 rolls around, and the billing department at UC Irvine, which, of course, they want to get paid for these expensive hospital bills, they contact Lauren and they say, hey, we seem to be having a problem. Anthem is saying that little baby Sadie is not on your health plan.
Wait, this is the same Anthem she called 3 days after the baby and they said, no problem, you're covered.
Exactly.
Okay, I want to make sure everybody remembers the conversation because you almost want graph paper as we have this conversation. Okay.
Well, yeah, it is. And it's almost like, you know, someone wants to blame the mom,
right,
for missing a deadline. And I think it's important to think about the context because it turns out the federal law actually includes allowances for this type of context.
Yeah.
So she calls her employer, Dignity Health, which, again, Dignity Health is owned by the Catholic Church, and their mission statement says that they want to extend the healing ministry of Jesus to the world. And now I think you know my faith background. I'm a Christian, so I'm not anti-Christian.
He went to divinity school, everyone. I just want everyone to know I love you, Marshall, and keep going.
Yeah, I spent 5 years in ministry before I was in journalism.
Right.
So I'm not some hater. But I just think that if somebody is going to have certain Christian ideals, they should actually, you know, live up to them.
Right.
So the company says you missed the 31-day deadline to sign your baby up for the plan. And Lauren said, what do you mean? I called the insurance company. I talked to a hospital. Everybody said the baby was covered. And they said, no, you had to go on to our web portal on our website, and you had to, you know, tick the box to add the baby to the plan. You didn't do that, so you missed the deadline, so we're not covering your bills. So while Lauren is in the hospital,
this is incredible,
in the neonatal intensive care unit, you know, hoping and praying that her baby recovers and survives its first months of life, she's told that her employer will not be covering any of the bills for her for the baby's birth.
Right. What did she
So do? The plan allows for 2 appeals, and these are written appeals that you make if you are denied coverage. So in this case, it wasn't the insurance company denying the care; it was her employer.
Right.
She writes two appeals where she basically begs her employer to allow the baby to be on the plan. She's apologetic. She says, I just didn't know. I didn't know that this was the rule. And they say, no luck. The rule is stated in the summary plan documents that you got when you were hired, even though she had been hired 6 years ago. And you
memorize those details. I just want to be, she wasn't having a baby 6 years ago. Nobody reads the details of that original employment, and you would never even think to connect that tiny little line with what's happening to you right now when you're having a premature baby.
Right, and they also said we mailed things to you, but she was not even living at home because she had been in the hospital for 10 days before the baby was born, and she was in the hospital after the baby was born. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't at home reading the fine print of the mail that they sent her. Mm-hmm. So they were heartless. I mean, they did not show mercy or compassion on a mom who didn't know how to sign her baby up and who didn't get the baby signed up by the deadline.
So, Marshall, I got to ask you a question. I just want to remember, in her appeals, she obviously did, and there have to be people at Anthem that said, yes, she called us 3 days, and we said, we assured her it was okay. And then she has to say she talked to the hospital at Irvine, and they said, yes, of course you're covered. So it's not like she had the baby and didn't do anything. She didn't cross their T, dot their I, but she crossed some T and some I, but not one that she would have been informed about 6 years sooner. I mean, if Donald Trump can't remember something that happened this morning, how does anybody remember some kind of an employment contract from 6 years ago where nobody in their right mind would remember that at all because they probably would never have read it?
Well, that's exactly right. So she did make efforts to sign the baby up. And so her appeals were denied, and so the bills started rolling in. She got one bill for over $60,000. She got one for $17,000. But then the big doozy came just earlier this month when she got a bill in the mail for $898,984. One bill for almost $900,000.
Right. So were they afraid of you, Marshall Allen? Were they afraid of the story of ProPublica?
You know, you do find this a lot as a journalist, that a lot of big institutions, especially in healthcare, I would say, they seem to care a lot more about their reputation than they do about how they actually treat people. And so I was notified about this by a source of mine, and Lauren did post this also on Facebook. So I contacted Dignity Health, and the day after I contacted Dignity Health, one of their senior executives contacted Lauren personally and said, we're so sorry to hear about this. There seems to have been some type of confusion, and we want to help you.
Oh, God.
And then one day after that, they had added the baby to the plan. And so all of those bills, which almost amounted to $1 million, basically $1 million of the bills are now being processed as we speak by Anthem, and they should be covered. In the end, it turns out to be a positive ending.
No, it's not a positive ending, Marshall, because you can't be there for every story.
It's a positive ending for Lauren because she's not going to be destroyed by $1 million in medical bills.
Right,
we'll just,
exactly.
We'll
limit
that
it
caveat.
To that. Let me tell you where my head is going as I'm listening to this. So I'm going to relate it to a conversation that has nothing to do with healthcare, but I think it's really important for people to understand this. So, you know, this is the problem. Nobody is an insurance expert. Half of the insurance people that work in the industry are not experts. Most people do what they think is normal, okay? It is rational to call Anthem and say I had a baby. It's rational to call the hospital. It is not even within my repertoire to recognize that there's a difference between really an employer-provided, you know, coverage versus an insurance company. I don't know the difference. Look at me. I'm 66. I'm asking you all these questions now going, gee, was I ever in a plan that was covered by ERISA? I don't even remember. But, you know, because you just think that it's sort of generic. Because you don't have a level of expertise. And I go back to what happened during the 2008 economic meltdown. And you're going to think I'm crazy, Marshall. But I know a lot of people that were talking about, you know, people getting these liar loans and all these people and all these people who were deceptive or whatever. And I'm thinking, I would go and buy a house maybe twice in a lifetime, if ever once. My area of expertise in mortgage law, buyback, bankruptcy, very negligible. The guy that's selling me the plan, that's selling me the mortgage, an expert. He does 15 or 25 maybe a week, okay? So there's a
right.
You come to the table with an assumption of either lots of information and knowledge or not. Wasn't there a responsibility on the part of her hospital and on the part of Dignity knowing this
that they should have humanly contacted her. She's not a cog. She's a freaking nurse working at that institution. I mean, it's not even – I mean, that's the part that absolutely kills me. You, especially as you mentioned, this was sort of, you know, it's funded, it's related to the Catholic Church, that there is not only an idea of compassion, but part of compassion is you don't send something in an envelope with a stamp. You actually make an inquiry in person. And given that she had done what you and I would have done, it just seems not only – immoral, but it's not just.
Well, yeah. So Dignity Health said, you know, they sent me a statement. They wouldn't do an interview with me, but they said in a statement that they're going to work on their communication process to try and improve it. So maybe that's addressing this. But I think the other thing that's important is the federal law actually does make accommodations for these exact type of circumstances.
Wow.
The federal law says that employers are allowed to make exceptions if, for some reason, an employee does not follow the rules as laid out in their plan. All it says is they're not allowed to do it in a way that's discriminatory or that's biased in favor of some employers over or some employees over another.
Right.
But they could put in their provisions that if somebody misses the deadline to sign up their baby because they were sick in the hospital and the baby was clinging to life and they weren't living at home, they could make an exception. They just chose not to. And I think one of the things that's kind of the harshest here is that Dignity Health told her for a year that the law did not allow them to make a change.
Oh.
And that's absolutely wrong. The law does allow them to make a change. And the law even says there's a provision in the law that says if somebody is suffering from adverse health conditions, then they should be viewed more favorably by the health plan. So they're supposed to especially give accommodation to an employee who's going through, you know, a health crisis and their baby's health crisis. So I think that's kind of the part that, you know, to not know your own law that you're supposed to be adhering to, and then to say that the law does not allow you to make an exception when it does, that's really not a fair way to treat one of your employees.
I have to let you go, but I want to do one quick follow-up question. And we're talking with Marshall Allen from ProPublica. His beat is sort of the health insurance hustle, and we're hearing about, you know, suddenly the claim of ignorance on the part of employers who actually have these plans and have experts on their that work with them and lawyers that work with them. And of course, they should be knowledgeable about this. But here's the other point. She did – you said that they contract out to something like an Anthem to basically sort of work for them because it's technically not insurance, but they need someone who can navigate. She called Anthem 3 days after she had the baby. How the hell did Anthem not know what she was required to do? If you're going to contract out with Anthem, then Anthem should have said, this is the requirement of your employer. Thank you very much. Yes, you'll be covered if you do this. See, my problem isn't even with the company, Dignity, as much as Anthem. If you're going to contract with Anthem, then Anthem should know what to tell these people because they're relying on them. That's their real contact with insurance of whatever kind this is, even though it's technically not insurance. But they're the middleman. And shouldn't the middleman be informed this way? This is why I hate the system. The system isn't here to serve you. The system is here to figure out how to not serve you. And that's why I was offended from the very beginning with Dignity. But in some ways, I'm also angry that Dignity didn't require Anthem to provide their people with the kind of information they need because they come from a place of ignorance, not a place of knowledge.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Arnie, because there's multiple areas where this was dropped.
Oh, it's and this is why these are the stories that need to come out. You like your insurance? Maybe not. You like your coverage? Maybe not. Do you want to go to a doctor when you're sick? Yes. Do you want to go to a doctor when you have a new baby? Yes. Do you need to tell someone you just had a new baby? Anyway, Marshall Allen, thank you so much for writing what you do. And I am glad because you tell the story better than anyone else. And these are the stories that need to be told. Sadly, there isn't a Marshall Allen for every horror story out there. But thank God for the ones that you do find. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Arnie.
All right, ciao. Bye-bye. ProPublica, everyone. I tell you, I love that. I love that site. All right. We're going to do a little labor history next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1959. That was the day that the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision that would be a blow to the cause of labor. Striving for the kind of major gains they had won in 1956, the 500,000 members of the United Steelworkers of America once again went out on strike. The steel industry was extremely profitable, and the workers demanded to share in the fruits of their labor. Management wanted the ability to introduce new technology and policies to cut hours and employees. The strike wore on for more than 100 days. President Dwight D. Eisenhower ordered the steelworkers back to the plants. He argued that the Taft-Hartley Act gave him the legal means to issue the order. A decade earlier, Congress had passed the Taft-Hartley Act over President Harry Truman's veto as a way to curtail union rights. The steelworkers protested the constitutionality of the law all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The union lost. In making its decision, the court referenced President Eisenhower's explanation of the impact of the strike, writing, quote, "The strike has closed 85% of the nation's steel mills, shutting off practically all new supplies of steel. Over 500,000 steelworkers and about 200,000 workers in related industries, together with their families, have been deprived of their usual means of support. Present steel supplies are low, and the resumption of full-scale production will require some weeks. If production is not quickly resumed, severe effects upon the economy will endanger the economic health of the nation." The next January, the union and management signed a new contract. The workers won a 7-cent an hour raise, a new automatic cost of living adjustment, improvements in their pension and health care benefits, and job protections against proposed automation.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Climate change can make people sick, and it can even be deadly. Kim Knowlton is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Our warming planet, it's putting millions of us at risk for heat-related illness and even death. That heat contributes to urban air pollution. That's from ground-level ozone, from wildfire smoke, from more pollen in the air.
Climate change can also cause dangerous floods and increase the spread of disease.
And the list goes on.
Knowlton co-authored a study analyzing 10 events in 2012, including wildfires, a hurricane, and a West Nile virus outbreak. All of the sorts of events projected to become more frequent or severe as the climate warms. More than 900 people died as a result of those events. Almost 40,000 visited the emergency room or were hospitalized. The costs in human suffering are hard to calculate, but some of the financial costs are measurable. The study found that health care and lost wages from just the 10 events in that 1 year cost $1.6 billion. And unless carbon pollution is sharply reduced, the financial and human costs will grow. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Democrat put us on our feet. The crazy women, they vote them out. Democrats put us on our feet. The crazy women, they vote them out. But I don't think they make the same mistake. They won't make the same mistake no more. He told him, "I'll send your sons home." He did just that. He sent them home to stay without a job, out of class. They won't make that same mistake no more. Democrats put us on our feet. The crazy women, they vote them out. I ain't going down, I ain't going down. No, I ain't. I ain't going down to that welfare store. It won't be long for the Democrats to be back in again.
Won't be long before the Democrats are back in again. I'm not going down to that welfare store. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. No, Ken is not here, but Fred Portnoy picked our song, John Lee Hooker, I'm a Democrat Man. I love it. I love it. All right. Joining us as he does every Thursday is Stefan Schmidt, affectionately known as Dr. Politics from Iowa State. Have you ever heard that song? I'm a Democrat Man, and sometimes they'll be back in. I love it, Stefan. How are you?
It's a great song. I mean, Hooker is a great entertainer and songwriter, and his voice is so great. And this is a funny theme, yeah.
Yeah, it's important. I mean, given what happened. Well, from what happened the other day, at least in Kentucky, which was so interesting because it was all about the governor. I mean, the Democrats did not have any coattails, right. But what they did have was, I think, a synergistic effect. Republican governor Stefan, who everybody hated. I mean, there wasn't any group that he didn't offend. And by the way, you know where he's from originally? Do you know this?
He's
from New Hampshire. Yeah.
No.
He's a schmuck from New Hampshire.
To get rid of him, yeah.
Yeah, we did. We sent him to Kentucky, and they got rid of him, too. So you know what this reminds me of? This is so funny. So not only did he offend everyone, so there was kind of this synergistic effect that they really didn't like him. I'm not sure it had as much to do with Trump as it had to do with him.
Right.
But the other thing is that he really attacked the public school teachers. And they organized and reached out, and I think they worked their tails off in ways nobody had ever seen before. So between offending, you know, the educators and offending everybody else, there wasn't a constituency that didn't find an excuse to vote for him, but to vote against him. So it was useful. And I think to read more into the Kentucky race than that is a little bit of a stretch.
It is a stretch, but also, you know, it really was a smack at Donald Trump because, you know, Trump said, this guy is crazy and, you know, he's doing all kinds of terrible things, but please vote for him because if you don't, then they're going to say that this is the end of Trump. And they voted for his opponent. So I think for Trump and for the Republicans, both the Virginia, incredible Virginia race. Takeover of all three of the major institutions. I mean, the House, the Senate, the governorship. And this race at least had somewhat of a chilling effect.
So I have not been able to reach out to any. I actually have a couple of contacts in Kentucky, and I got to reach out to them because I'm kind of curious because everybody else, all the other Republicans won. I think there was even a black Republican who won as attorney general. So what I'm kind of curious about is did they run as Trump Republicans or did they run really focused on the state and Kentucky? And yes, they were the Republican flavor, but they didn't associate themselves as closely with Trump as the governor did. I mean, the governor was beyond arrogant. I mean, he was like, of course it's about Trump. Of course it's about impeachment. No, honey bun, it's about Kentucky and what you're doing with health care and what are you doing with the pensions. And he was like almost like there was a disconnect between what his real job was and how he ran.
Well, I can answer it because all the analyses I've seen, and you've read most of them as well, say that the lesson from Virginia is to the Democrats, stick with the bread and butter issues that affect people's lives every day.
Absolutely.
That is healthcare, that is schools, that is public safety, that's jobs and also salaries, you know, having a living wage, and not Russia or even the impeachment, which kind of can run its own course. And there are interesting things coming out in the impeachment investigation. And as it becomes more public, I think that Republicans ought to be really worried because a lot of their prime remainders in the Trump administration are getting sucked into this vortex. And, you know, John Bolton, if he testifies, and if he testifies as the reports this afternoon suggest, it's going to be a bombshell. I mean, he's going to confirm that he quit because he thought that, you know, what was going on between the Trump administration and Ukraine was a threat to national security, to European security. And that would be incredible because Bolton, while the Democrats abhor him, liberals and progressives hate him, he had a lot of, and maybe still has a lot of creds with conservatives and Republicans. So,
well, but let me just say something. As someone who's worked on a couple of pieces of legislation, I'll use an example. So yes. Repeal of the death penalty. And so I worked on the repeal of the death penalty a number of times. And you know who my kissing cousin was? It was the Libertarians I fought with 98.9999999% of the time.
Yeah.
Here's the good news. The good news is we could come to consensus on this for very different reasons, okay?
That's true.
They don't trust government, so we don't want government to be able to kill anybody because we don't trust government with any kind of authority, any kind of regulatory authority. I looked at it as inhumane, as unjust. Yeah. I mean, and so in the end, we could do this kumbaya. But we were actually on different ships going in the same direction. And so that's
an interesting point.
Oh, no, and that's Bolton. Bolton, here's the one thing about Bolton. He has his version of right and wrong, okay? And he has his version. I mean, he's a war hawk. He is absolutely over the top. There isn't anything that you should not blow up. Well, that's absolutely true. And interestingly enough, though, one of his main focuses of blowing up is, you know, the former Soviet Union and the Russians and the Putins. So in an interesting way, that's where his right and wrong to some extent begins and ends. But there's a little bit of an overlap because we cared enough about Ukraine who was terrified about Russia. And there was enough overlap. And I think people need to understand on this – you can find common ground, not a lot, but when it comes to Donald Trump, he's in a sieve. He's between two places, and it's getting narrower and narrower because when I can agree with Bolton, you are in trouble, Donald Trump.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Arnie, and I think that is the magic formula for bipartisanship is you get together, you don't agree on a lot of different things, and don't try to agree on those because then you're going to fight. So find something that you can agree on and legislate on. And that's what's happening in the Senate, I think, with climate change. I mean, you've suddenly got a bipartisan coalition of senators beginning to talk about climate change, but maybe for different reasons, but they both are concerned about it.
And now we're seeing, there was an article I may have sent it to you, I think it came out of Reuters, talking about now how in hedge funds and Wall Street portfolios, they are now asking questions about how you are prepared, your business, your industry, for climate change.
Sure.
And I read this article and I said, well, someone's like, well, a million of you send this to Donald Trump. I mean, because he believes everything is, you know, rises and sets with the market. Everything happens on Wall Street. If it's good for Wall Street, it's good for his portfolio. Okay, and let's be honest here. And if they are asking the question, that means they're not only concerned, they're concerned economically as to whether they should include this company in their portfolio because they are not hardened for climate change or even prepared for it.
No, I think that is correct. And the problem is you got to get Hannity to talk about it.
Yes.
Because obviously if Fox isn't talking about it, then President Trump isn't very interested in it.
Exactly.
But I think that's changing. I think Fox is beginning to really worry that they are so joined at the hip with a president who is more and more shaky in terms of a lot of things that conservatives care about. So, it's an interesting time, Arnie.
Well, and I want to go back quickly to impeachment because then I want to leave it as quickly.
Yeah.
And that is – so I'm watching CNN and I'm watching in the morning and I'm watching MSNBC and then on occasion I switch to Fox. But, you know, Fox doesn't ever covers it really except to basically call everyone the enemy of Donald Trump. But as I'm watching it, I'm exhausted by it. And I understand there's going to be another bombshell and another bombshell and another bombshell. After a while, there are too many bombshells, so there are none.
Yeah.
No, I want people to hear this. When you have a bombshell every day, you don't have one. And that's kind of what's happening with this impeachment. And all it is reinforcing what the whistleblower said anyway. So in a lot of ways, the good news about this versus Mueller is that what the whistleblower said has turned out to be incredibly accurate. What Barr said was not. And Barr set the table the way the whistleblower set the table. The Barr table setting distorted everything we heard because it went through the Barr lens after we heard the Mueller report, and it kind of landed with a dud. The difference now is that, one, he's president, which he wasn't president with the Mueller report technically, and two, more importantly, the result is you know, whether we impeach him or not, we know that what he did was probably corrupt, and Republicans are going to have a lot of difficulty explaining it. But it's, for me, it's kind of over because I know what I've heard, and it's accurate, and it just reinforces what I think about him. Now I care about health care, climate change, sure, infrastructure, taxes, jobs. And that's where I think the Democratic candidates have to focus on, because impeachment is almost yesterday's story.
Yeah. No, Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete, is rising in the polls, incredibly rising in the polls in Iowa. And one of the reasons is what he is now saying, which is, this is not about fighting. This is about bringing together people on common issues and solving those problems. And I think that's a good message, and I think that's connecting with people. And I think, in a way, what you're saying is, let's talk about bread and butter issues and how we may be able to begin to bridge some of the gap between the different factions that are there. The only thing I would add, though, is that the continuous rollout of very damaging information, and even today the information that Attorney General Barr apparently believes that what President Trump was doing was not legal, and that there is a high level of tension rising now between President Trump and his attorney general. That is important because it tweaks President Trump's nerves,
yes,
and sets him off in things that are destructive to himself. And it's kind of a psychological warfare that probably makes President Trump not be able to sleep very well and maybe, do more irrational things that don't connect with the public. So in that sense, that's the impeachment track over there, bringing in all kinds of credible people.
That
has to undermine his sense of security.
The Roger Stone trial is happening now, too, and it's already showing that everybody lied there, too. And it goes directly back to Mueller, which is so interesting. So in a bizarre way, you see lying with Mueller, and Mueller was like, that was 25 years ago, excuse me. and now we've got what's coming out right now, which is just, so there is this clearly synergistic effect. And I think the people that are the most distraught about this are the Republicans who are going to have to vote on this. Because are they going to vote for a democracy in a democratic institution on the concept of right or wrong, or are they going to vote to cover their proverbial you-know-whats? And that will be fascinating because one of the things that Donald Trump showed, at least in the Kentucky race, was that even when you show up and you basically beg everyone in Kentucky where you won by 30 points in 2016, wow, it's not as magical today.
Yeah, it's not as magical. And I think that's always the lesson, isn't it?
Yes.
All politics is local.
Yes.
And there are these firestorms and these incredibly exciting and dramatic things happening. But in the end, it comes down. And I think that's how Democrats took over the House again, is the candidates that ran, they ran on the issues that connected in their communities, right, in their districts. That's a great lesson.
And I'm going to share something with you. The Washington Post called me the other day to ask me about Bernie and, Bernie after the heart attack and what's happening with Bernie and his numbers, and he's doing better in New Hampshire. What does that mean? Is he taking it out of the hide of Elizabeth Warren? Yeah, the typical bull.
Yes.
And one of the things I said was, I said Bernie made a mistake in a lot of ways, in some ways similar to Donald Trump, which tells you it's a politician's mistake.
Mm.
And that is that you assume because you were successful with a group two or three years ago, that you don't really need to sort of massage them in the same way, and that you can walk in and everything that was your success strategy from two or three years ago will work today.
Yeah.
And so that's what you saw with Donald Trump in Kentucky. In a lot of ways, that's what I think Bernie's mistake was with New Hampshire. And that was, he did wildly successful against Hillary Clinton, cleaned her clock here.
Right.
Big turnout and big turnout for him. And he just basically assumed, even though now there were like 20 people running or maybe 16 now, that he didn't need to come back here and reinforce and remind people why they supported him, even though they were now being given lots of different choices. And it wasn't Hillary that a lot of people knew they didn't want and didn't like because she was so wedded to Wall Street. And so by that assumption, he didn't do what politicians need to do, which is to come back, re-engage, remind, have a conversation, make a phone call. And all of a sudden, when he saw Elizabeth Warren doing better and Mayor Pete doing better and even Biden showing up for a while, I think he had to regroup. He had to rehire people, and he had to make phone calls that he hadn't made 4 and 5 months ago. And that is a problem. You have to never assume that what happened yesterday will happen tomorrow.
No, I mean, politics is very fluid and evolutionary. And the other thing I think he has to do is sharpen and redefine his message. He can't stick with the same message that he has essentially ridden on for many, many years, because 2019, 2020 is different from the last time around. And so let me ask you a question, which yeah. I couldn't have the answer to. I was asked today by a political consultant in Iowa, Kamala Harris is pulling out of New Hampshire.
Yeah. They won't notice.
Good idea, bad idea.
They won't notice.
Was she really not doing well?
No, they won't notice. They won't notice. Yeah. I don't know what it is, but Kamala has never been able to create the connection. And I'm not sure it's who she is, how she presents, what her message is, whatever that message is. But there was so much hope at the very beginning when she had that huge announcement, and then there was never. I mean, I listen to Corey and there's connection. I listen to Julian and there's connection. Mm. I listen to Beto even though he dropped out. But I listen to Kamala and I'm like, what's missing? What's missing?
Really?
And it's about – and remember, what we do in Iowa and what we do in New Hampshire is that you're dating. This is not about a president, everyone. Let me just sit everyone down. You know, you will eventually get a chance to pick the president. What Iowa and New Hampshire and to some extent South Carolina and Nevada get to do is we get to date. And when you're dating people, you're not necessarily going to marry them, but you're definitely interested in them. And I'm dating a lot of people right now. I'm not dating one kid. No, it's absolutely true. But I never dated Kamala. Ever, ever, ever. Wow. She wasn't on my short list, you know. Mm-hmm. And that to me tells me that there was something missing there. And what's happening, I know she's moving to Iowa. I think Joe might have to move to Iowa too, because he's not doing well either. But where is Biden? Fourth in the polls in Iowa?
Yes, he is, yes.
Now explain that to me.
Well, sure. But Kamala apparently is now saying she's going to put all her chips in Iowa, maybe, but Iowa, she's not going to do very well.
She's
South
not.
Carolina.
No.
South Carolina is where she thinks she can get
but
a
she's
new
not
boost
doing well
from,
there
from black voters.
And yet, that's not a name you hear coming out of South Carolina either.
No, you don't.
So
no.
It's going to be – so just real quickly, I know maybe why Biden doesn't do well in New Hampshire. You tell me why Biden doesn't do well in Iowa.
Probably the same reason. I mean, I think, you know, people are saying there's now – A good selection of candidates.
Yeah.
Biden kind of represents, you know, the stuck in a few years back. He's not a good campaigner, Arnie. He's never been a good campaigner.
Never. I know.
And I think, honestly, I think that the connection with Ukraine and his son making $50,000 a month there on a consultant firm with some energy company that is dubious. I think that's hurt him as well.
Yeah.
It's an ethics issue.
Yeah.
And so, it might have been his time if he had run, you know, against Hillary Clinton. It might have been, but I sort of doubt it. He's just not a great candidate.
Well, and whether the progressives are going to win in 2020, the progressive agenda has won. They don't like big money. They don't like, I mean, all these things, and he's sitting there sleeping with the super PACs, and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Sure.
And you just kind of go, I mean, even if he's going to do a super PAC, do the super PAC after Iowa and New Hampshire. Don't do the super PAC now. But I mean it's almost like just call me up. I mean, I can understand you want to sleep with the PACs, but you don't, you know, if you sleep with the PACs at the very beginning when every progressive in the country is focusing on this race, this is not a good time to show those kinds of cards. You know what I mean?
He needs the money.
I know, because nobody's writing a check to him. I get that too.
No, they aren't. But here's the deal.
Oh.
It's not hurting Mayor Pete. And Mayor Pete is getting huge amounts of money from investment firms, from Wall Street, from the financial services industry.
Mayor Pete's
Why? Huge amounts of money. And the reason is they're terrified that
Elizabeth
Warren is going to pull out of this a winner. And then, you know, her regulatory regime is frightening. And so, Mayor Pete is kind of, you know, sort of.
I got the question for Mayor Pete.
He's the alternative to Biden.
I got the question for Mayor Pete.
Way.
Ready for this? Here, Mayor Pete, will you bring Larry Summers and Tim Geithner into your administration? I'm dying to ask that question. I'm a genius. Thank
you're
you.
Mean,
I love you. No, I'm
mean,
not mean. I'm genius because that's the code. That's the code. Because I'd love to hear his answer.
But remember what happened with Barack Obama. I have several very progressive friends in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
They said, oh, thank God Obama is not going to take any PAC money, and he's not going to take big bundles from big donors. Mm-hmm. And then Obama looked and said, unless I get big chunks of money like that, I'm going to be defeated. So Obama took a lot of the same kind of money that well, in this case, Mayor Pete now is taking. And so that's always the question is, you know, can you basically win against big political machines like Donald Trump or the Republicans, really, without raising substantial amounts of money? So the answer is no.
All right, so here's the third question I want to ask Mayor Pete. So I want to ask him about Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, and then I want to ask him, if you had selected an attorney general and you were president in 2008, would you have picked Holder, and would you have expected your Holder not to do a perp walk with any of those Wall Street tycoons that took us to our economic knees? What do you think about jail time? That's my question. Do you like jail time or do you like fines? If you only like fines, I don't want to talk to you. If you like jail time, we can have a conversation. I'm dead serious. I want him on the record. Not one person in any of the frickin' debates has ever asked those kinds of questions, and I think it's really important. And then last but not least, Stefan Schmidt, I have to share an article with you because I just thought it was absolutely fascinating. The big question for the Democrats is going to be about health care. And, of course, everybody is saying, look what the governor of Kentucky did, the new Democrat. He talked all about the Affordable Care Act, Affordable Care Act. See, that proves that that's the answer. So let me tell you something. You know what that proves? That proves you absolutely need a Medicare for All conversation. You know why? Because of Bernie and Elizabeth and a lot of the progressives now talking about Medicare for All, something that was even foreboding. You were arrested if you talked about it before. It has now made the ACA the conservative solution.
Yeah.
It is not now the liberal socialist Obamacare. It is now the ACA, and the ACA looks like a modest conservative massage the situation example. And I think that is why you love Medicare for All, because it gives everyone cover when they look at public option or the ACA, because it looks so yesterday and almost reasonable and tepid.
Well, the ACA has been damaged by tweaking it on the part of the Republicans.
Yes.
And so it isn't functioning the way it was intended to.
Exactly.
Your first part of this hour, that conversation about the woman who had a baby and then the insurance thing got all screwed up and she got billed almost $1 million was an absolutely brilliant, unbelievable interview that you did. And it should be listened to by every person who's going to vote in 2020.
Yes.
But the whole point there was that you still have these trashy insurance company policies that don't cover things, that hide things, that make it so difficult for people to figure out how they can get covered and compensation.
It's awful.
And that, you know, that is an indictment of the way the system is working now, and it's true that it has to be changed.
So there was an article, let me just share this with you before I let you go. We're talking with Stefan Schmidt, who we so adore. And the piece was at Slate.com. Listen to the title. The Medicare for All conversation is surreal. And what he says in his piece is, why are we so hysterical about this? And he says, one part of the answer is that presidential campaigns aren't just about making realistic promises about what you'll do in the White House, but are also about laying out a broader philosophical vision. They're also a chance to change public opinion. Single payer was barely on the public's radar before Bernie Sanders ran in 2016. Now it's mainstream. And while Sanders and Warren might have little chance of passing Medicare for All as president, their efforts to build support for it could pay off one day down the line because they started the conversation. Bernie did. Elizabeth and Bernie now, it's synergistic. And what I posted this on Facebook is I want to remind everyone about why defending private insurance is garbage. And that's for this reason. What does private insurance want to do? They want to make a profit. What does private insurance not like? They don't like old people, poor people, or sick people. I mean, let's be honest here. And when you realize that's what they don't like.
Half the country.
Exactly. Their motto is, give me your healthy and your young. Oh, screw you, private insurance.
Oh,
but we couldn't even say this, Stefan, without talking about Medicare for All, because there would be no real comparison.
Yeah. And in Iowa, you can't say it because we are the second largest insurance capital of America.
Yeah. next to Connecticut.
So I can't
I'm sure.
say that. I can't say what you just said, yeah. or I'll be deported, you know, to northern Mexico, to the, you know, poor Mormon community.
Oh, that was horrible, too. Oh, my God. Yeah. Anyway, thank you, Stefan Schmidt, so much, and we will talk
always
to you next.
Always a pleasure,
Arnie. It is always a pleasure. And I just want to remind everyone, Stefan, that as we're talking about these issues, what is celebratory about the 16 or 20, whatever number of candidates we have, is we have been liberated to talk about this. And I will let MSNBC and CNN talk about impeachment, and they're just building and building and building. And that's going to be the Republican senators' rut that they're going to dig their grave in. But right now, it doesn't impact my life. And presidential candidates need to understand that if they don't talk about what impacts my life, I don't really want to hear from them. Impeachment is not their story. Their story is election.
Brilliant.
All right. Thank you so much, Stefan Schmidt. I really appreciate it. All right. Here we go. All right, everyone. And how do we end, Mr. Portnoy? We're ending with something that actually relates to the governor of Kentucky. Am I right? It does. It's entitled Teacher Strike Blues. This is the name of the group. Angry, tired teachers? They must have met my parents. All right, stick around, everyone. See you next week.
Teachers cool, you'll never become rich. District don't have the money, that's their pitch. So how can they give themselves high raises when they can't provide us with their the district in some white collar town.